nomination when I didn't have as much name recognition as I do now from all the press. And, you know, I think the way to do it is just to try to, you know, use this moment, you know, to try to start appealing to people all across the nation, especially like the Sanders supporters who were able to, you know, give Bernie Sanders a competitive campaign with small donations without corporate funding. And, you know, I think, you know, we need to really make the case that for the revolution to continue, you know, those people, those same donors need to start donating to congressional candidates all over the country.
Misty Snow, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank both of you for joining us. Yep. You've both made history, Misty Snow in Utah and Misty Plowright in Colorado, the first openly trans women to win their party's nomination for the race in November. That does it for the show. Tune in Monday for our July 4th special when we feature the words of Frederick Douglass and Saul Williams and Jesse Williams. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8 a.m. Do you have used furniture, household goods, clothing, etc.? Things that are good enough for resale? Well, you know that place on 7th and Northeast Fremont, Rerun? If you take your things in there, and they sell them, the proceeds will go to KBOO Radio after they sell it. So if you want to do that, sell some of your unneeded items at Rerun, call 503-517-3786 to arrange for a consignment appointment. So call Rerun for a consignment appointment so that you can sell some of your things to benefit KBOO Radio. Next up, it's Positively Revolting Talk Radio, but first I need to tell you that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Nape Farms. Specializing in sustainable you-pick blueberry practices, Nape Farms You-Pick Blueberries is located at 10280 Southeast Orient Drive in Boring, Oregon. For more information, the number is 503-663-0885 or online at napifarms.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Soul City Supper Club concert series on Saturday, July 2nd at the Star Theater in Portland. This month features local soul artist Ronnie Wright with new vocal diva Tamara Stevens and surprise guests from the Bespeak Project. The event will also have guest DJs, door prizes, and more. Again, that's the Soul City Supper Club concert series with Ronnie Wright and Tamara Stevens on Saturday, July 2nd at the Star Theater, 13 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought,
and good morning. There we are.
Now I hear you.
I found me.
Good morning. Here we are. I'm Positively Revolting on your very own community radio station, KBOO. It's about 4 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning. Where else would you be? You'd be joining us on a Friday morning. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And this morning, look at us go. This is the the Friday before Independence Day. This is that Friday that we thought we would take a little moment and we would look at things and such. Things like U.S. imperialism. Things like wars never ending. Things like, what does it mean, independence? And in this context of the military-industrial complex that strangles our domestic economy and, well, you know, sets us up as the world police. You know, what do we mean by all of this stuff? And let's focus on it right now, right here on KBOO. Again, your community radio station. We are hoping to be joined with S. Brian Wilson, and legendary peace activist, and the subject of a new documentary, Paying the Price for Peace, which will be premiering this Sunday at the Clinton Street Theater. And that'll be a special presentation with Brian present, as well as the film's producers and directors, Bo Bodart and Frank Dorrell, the associate producer.
Well, and we have to not dump on Brian, there is an incident at the on the Hawthorne Bridge this morning, and if he was coming across it,
we have no idea what's
going
on
anywhere.
But what I'm saying is, we hope that he's going to join us momentarily, but he ain't here yet. So in the meantime, talking about those concepts of, in fact, war and peace, talking about the concepts of, well, you know, where we're at again with this military-industrial, you know, state in which we live.
I don't remember, do you, any time that we've been at peace?
Mm-mm. No, and I think...
I do.
Oh, here he is.
It was very brief. I'll just be out of here.
Fine. We'll just rearrange the room here for a moment, and it'll all be good. In fact, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You too can join us in this conversation as we create live radio. Apparently, Teresa has ran from the room.
But Brian is coming.
But it's an amazing sort of random, sort of, it's a changing. I feel a little like a magician. It's like we put down a curtain. There was Teresa. We raised the curtain. There is Brian. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
There's our engineering pixie adjusting microphones, and here we go. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us,
Brian.
Thank you
for having me.
Absolutely. We were just talking about war, peace, imperialism, you know, the U.S. In a nutshell.
Right.
A little less on the peace, a lot more on the war, unfortunately. And Lynn had just put forth the question, you know, have we actually, in our lifetimes, ever been at peace? And I don't think we have. You know, with one thing and another, whether we were openly declared in a war or not. I was born in 1966, and it seems like there is a absolute chain between the covert you know, wars and where we're at today.
You talk about addiction to war, so.
Yeah, we're addicted to war because we're addicted to a way of life that's extremely consumptive. And now it makes huge amounts of money for very few people. So the money making itself drives now the wars. We need the threats, so we create them.
You think? Yes,
I
know.
We create them, and therefore the people, they think the people are going to agree that we need to then intervene to deal with the threat, which of course is all about making more bullets, more planes, more ships. And it makes a lot of money. In fact, it's the foundation of now of our economy. But we've been a war economy since World War II. Mm-hmm. Between overt and covert interventions, we have never been free of an intervention since World War II. 390 overt interventions since World War II, and thousands of covert interventions. We don't even know how many.
Let's just stop for a moment. 390 overt interventions.
Overt.
And so when we think about how much war that is, right? I mean, for thinking of, like, you know, middle school history books. If we think about the pablum that is on those pages, we will think, oh, well, then there was, you know, the Second World War, and then there was the Korean conflict and the Vietnam police action. And then we are relatively, you know, scot-free until we get to the war in Iraq, right? And so... But there was
plenty of covert stuff going on before the war.
But my point is, if you're talking about 390 overt acts, those are the only ones we actually have in our public consciousness,
right? Well,
not
390 in the public consciousness. The 390 comes from a lot of research, from a lot of sources.
Exactly.
When did we send the Marines here? When did we send the Marines there?
Exactly.
When did we have a Navy... a warship at a port in which certain Marines were being unloaded to do a certain small action.
Exactly.
And many of these have not been in the news or in the public consciousness. The ones you mentioned are in the public consciousness.
Exactly. So we have these, like, you know, four or, you know, five that are in the public consciousness, but 390 that are declared, that are upfront.
Oh,
that
they're
are,
not declared.
Well,
that
yeah,
we don't
are.
Have, they don't have to do that anymore.
They don't have to. They've only done it five times in our history.
That are not hidden, I guess, is what I'm trying to say here. That are for public knowledge, you know, and again, the thousands, as you said, of the covert actions that, you know, that deeper research will start to turn up. But that, what is that, you know, that frequency, that amount is absolutely staggering to me.
It's astounding to me.
And it reaches to all corners of the world.
That's correct.
What seems to be the driving thread that ties that all together?
Well, I think it's these two things. One is over time we have become accustomed to living in a way that's not just in the world. We have 4.6% of the world's population consuming probably 30% of the world's resources. The only way you can do that is through theft, by force or threat of force, and we develop a whole language. A whole mythology of called exceptionalism.
I was just going to say that is the best sold piece of it's propaganda ever.
It's incredible, though, how successful it is when the people's lives revolve around desperately making money to make do. They don't have time to critically think, and they don't really want to know what's going on because it's very disturbing.
There's some sort of weird comfort that some people get by the thought of Americans being exceptional.
Well, I would say that a lot of people take comfort. I mean, all my family back in the East Coast, for example, that's probably one reason I'm on the West Coast.
Well, yeah, of course.
Well, and I mean, that gets into that whole chauvinistic mindset that, you know, the myth of meritocracy. Well, we're the greatest country in the world. Of course we
are. That's what I grew up believing.
Are, you know, and we're actually kind of... hearing that sentiment parroted again, you know, make America great again for what and how exactly would be another question, you know, because again, that is a direct appeal to that exceptionalist mindset.
Yeah, it's but again, not just.
So when did that change for you? So you grew up thinking that.
Well, it started a little tiny bit before I was in the military. I was in law school when I was drafted, actually.
Back in the old days.
Out of my second year, yeah, during the old conscription draft.
Yes.
Before the lottery even.
Oh, wow.
I was my second year in law school. I lived in the Washington, D.C. jail as part of a program I was involved with, studying law and doing an internship as a person who lived in, ate in, and spent most of my time at the D.C. jail as a law student my second year. That was a little bit, for a country boy from upstate New York, that was a bit of a...
eye-opener?
Yeah, and I that whole year I attended the black Muslim meetings every week, and I was the only white guy in the room. I was no threat to anybody. I was just a innocent kid listening. I wonder whether what these guys are saying is really true about our society. And... it made an imprint on me, but I was still, you know, pretty conservative. And then I was drafted, and I actually drafted out of, I was living in the jail when I went in the military, because that was where I was when I was still a law student. And then I did 4 years in the military, but the third year I was sent to Vietnam as a lieutenant in charge of 40 men protecting air bases. And while there, I was asked to do a so-called extra duty. It wasn't even something I had to do, but I did it as a favor to a colonel, a Vietnamese colonel. And I was to assess the success or failure of the bombings of targets. And these were new South Vietnamese pilots just trained by the U.S., new jet fighter planes given to the Vietnamese by the U.S. under Nixon's Vietnamization program. It was 1969. And what I discovered, which shocked me, and I've never been the same since, all the five targets I examined were all inhabited, undefended fishing villages. And everybody in those villages was killed in the bombings, usually by napalm. Most of those killed were young children and mothers. And I have to say, my paradigm of the greatest country in the history of the world, and this pride I had of being an American, was destroyed in a second. I was 27 years old. I was old for a non-lifer. And I knew it was all a lie. And I knew probably everything I'd been taught was a lie about history, American history, world history, from my American teachers. I should say U.S. American teachers. And it began a long journey of questioning. And I think my empathy was born pretty intensely. I became very empathic with Vietnamese people, not empathic with my fellow soldiers. And I couldn't believe this was happening to me, but I couldn't change it. I was altered.
Right.
I was philosophically, spiritually, intellectually altered. I would say in a good way.
Right.
It was a hard way to do it, but I have to say that it never leaves. So the curiosity and the motivation to tell the truth as I know it from my experiences became kind of part of the journey, almost an intrinsic part of the journey. I can't separate myself from this expression of describing the lie and how pathological the lie is and how it impacts us as human beings terribly. I mean, in Vietnam, I realized when I was looking at all these bodies, I knew then that I was looking at the consequence of my ignorance.
In the face.
In the face. Yeah. And that those people were just as equally valid as I was, but actually more authentic, because I was an ideologue and they were living in their village. You know, so
right.
It was, I guess it maybe because I was 27, it just clicked.
So that was a moment that really altered your life forever.
It did.
And when you finished with the service, you became active with the Veterans for Peace?
No, Veterans for Peace as an organization was founded in 1985. But moment in the spring of 69, I became a...
Were you with Vietnam veterans?
I became a veteran for peace.
Right.
Before there was an organization.
Before there was an organization around.
Were you with VVAW, Vietnam Veterans?
I joined VVAW in 1971, Vietnam Veterans Against mm-hmm. the War. I was out in 1970, and I got out, fortunately, without a court-martial, and as a captain. And I just was so relieved to be out, and not having been formally punished, I was certainly informally admonished a lot by my superiors. And when I left Vietnam early, because I was ordered home early, I was speaking out against the war while I was there, I told my colonel commander that I wanted to remind him that Thomas Jefferson, the person that we all grew up admiring in our history, who was a slaveholder himself, he wrote, we were told, the Declaration of Independence, and in there he used the words, three words, merciless Indian savages. That's in the Declaration of Independence.
Absolute.
And I reminded him then that now I knew who the savages were, and it wasn't the indigenous. It was my ancestors, and I'm now one of them, and I'm renouncing it. I mean, it's like, this is not me. Mm-hmm. But, of course, I was on my way back to the States, and he just didn't take me seriously, of course.
But it is that same, that thread, really, from the founding of this country, where resources, you know, are gained by, you know, plunder, by murder, by theft. And looking at that legacy that was the very foundation of this country, here against the indigenous, to where we're at now around the world in each and every corner, in each and every pocket.
That's right. Those seeds were there. Forceful dispossession of 900 nations of people, and then forceful dispossession of hundreds of tribes of Africans by snatching them to become slaves, and not just for the U.S., but the whole hemisphere.
Yeah.
So we were founded on two genocides, the genocide of the indigenous and the genocide of Africans. So we stole the land, and we stole the labor. And that established, I think, a cultural DNA of entitlement without any kind of accountability. And psychically, as a culture, we are very spoiled. It's kind of like an adolescent who was never, no boundaries were ever imposed on that adolescent, no checks. And I think culturally we suffer from a kind of narcissism that is, it's excessive. And it's blinding. And when you can't see clearly, like a drunk, you make terrible choices. And perceived from outside, you're making choices that are very hurtful and harmful to others, as well as ultimately yourself, if you were awake. So I had an awakening, and I wasn't looking for an awakening.
Of course not. Most people aren't when they get them.
However, I am appreciative that the great spirit, whatever forces of the universe, was not going to let me slide. And I had been sliding. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew that I had been sliding. I didn't know that before, but I realized, wow, being a white male is pretty easy. It's not particularly profound, but it's comfortable. It's convenient, and I knew it was now an impediment. I had to recover, so I'm still call myself a recovering white male. I mean, the recovery process is lifetime. You're learning of assumptions and entitlements that you didn't even think about.
They
come off one at a time. Wow, oh yeah. So it's also humbling because, you don't know very much. But then when you don't know very much, you can pursue truths because you don't know a lot, and you get a lot of joy out of learning more about history and more about people. It's painful at times, but it's also very deeply satisfying that you're actually searching for true meaning and understanding by having more open eyes. And it's still a difficult journey. Because I live in the most pathological culture probably in the history of the world now. I mean, we've replaced others. But the denial is such an incredible defense mechanism for people and for cultures. It's, and understandably so. I mean, it's very disturbing to know the truth. It's very upsetting. It's I'm still in therapy. I'll be 75 on Monday. And the therapy keeps me grounded, and I process things. And because my fall in Vietnam, intellectually or ideologically, it was a long fall. Maybe only because I was 27 did I put things together. But for a week, I was suicidal in Vietnam. I had a 38 in my possession, and I remember one time putting it to my head, wondering if I had the courage to blow my brains out. My paradigm was gone.
Right.
However, the seeds of a new paradigm had emerged, because when I was looking at the Vietnamese on the ground in those villages, I realized they were my family. I mean, at a not in a cognitive way, but in a very visceral, spiritual, belly brain way and heart brain way. And that was the kernels of a new path. That everybody's connected. And when you harm somebody else, you harm yourself.
You know, as a young woman at that time in the early 70s, I remember my boyfriend was in VVAW, but the men that were in that were the only men I knew who had any idea what was going on. Now, everybody was messed up, but at least with PTSD or whatever, they actually had a clue.
We had a real experience of what imperialism looks like and what lies.
And it made everybody way better human beings, and it was that part was heartbreaking and heartening simultaneously.
Yeah, it was. Well, you can't adapt to the old. I mean, you can't adapt to where you had been before. You can't adapt back to the culture. You can't adapt into the culture because you know the culture is sick. So you have to figure out, what does it mean? I mean, you use alcohol, drugs, sex, sports to help you through that. And for me, it was telling the truth about the war. I mean, it was me expressing myself, and I didn't really want to be numbed at all. But I found, like you just described, my new tribe were veterans. And because we had all most of us had come from very straight homes and upbringings, and had been shocked into a reality. And it was basically fortunate that we were shocked into reality, but it's not easy when you don't have a culture that's going to be validating you or welcoming you or...
Well, and there's something about that paradigm shift, right? So when you lose one paradigm, it's not like you have another one ready to replace it.
Right, but when a paradigm dies, it gives room now for something new to grow. And it's
absolutely
true, it takes time.
And before a new one grows, there is that sense of cut a sea without, you know.
Well, it's also grief because I loved that paradigm.
Of course.
And losing it,
of course,
was very painful, even though I knew it was now not going to be anything I could ever recover, nor did I want to, but it had been a wonderful paradigm, emotionally and psychically, as a young kid growing up in upstate New York. And when I came back,
it's good to be king.
Huh?
As Tom Petty said, it's good to be king.
Yeah, yeah. I told my family when I came home, my parents and some of my extended family, that I didn't want their government or their church anymore. I was going to start over. I had to kind of rediscover what is important in life, and they didn't. It was hard for them. In fact, my parents never really recovered from it. Until they died, they didn't understand what happened to their good boy. I had been a good boy, and school, church, sports, and you know, it was hard for them.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of that now politically.
Yeah.
You know, it's very hard for people to see that things are changing. And change, you know, it's a great bumper sticker saying, change is great, you first.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
and people don't want always to see change. And so you were dropped into it where you kind of, it was either that or disintegrate.
Right. Yeah. Either blow my head off literally or just kind of drop, just become depressed, I guess. Yeah, I have to say I've been very fortunate. I've had a lot of good people around me over the years, and I guess maybe I either am attracted to certain people or certain people attracted to me because the change. They can see it in your eyes, in your face, in your smile, sometimes in your tears. But it's a life of it's a journey of meaning, a journey of life searching for meaning in a pretty empty society in a way, in terms of real depth and meaning. It's a consumer society. But, you know, and here we are in 2016, knowing that our modern way of life, carbon-based, meaning carbon-burning-based, is conceivably going to lead to our extinction in the not too distant future, because we are going to be choking on the carbon.
Yeah.
That we fought a cold war to preserve a way of life that we said was in jeopardy from another ideological center in the Soviet Union. And isn't it ironic that it's our way of life that's destroying us? The very way of life that we built this, all this weaponry around.
Is it paradoxical or ironic? I'm not sure. Lethal levels of irony. I'm telling you, we've reached lethal levels of irony. 503-231-8187, the number to call to join us. You are listening to Positively Revolting. This is KBOO Community Radio. We are joined this morning with Brian Wilson, who is a legendary peace activist and organizer, teacher, lawyer, around fantastic Portlander at this point. Thank you.
8 years I've been here.
Thank you for being, and thank you for being here. Yeah. Who's celebrating his birthday on Monday on the 4th of July, and is the subject of a new documentary, Paying the Price for Peace, that is screening, excuse me, on Sunday night at the Clinton Street.
7 p.m.
Yes, 7 p.m.
$10 for admission. That goes to the filmmaker because he's $100,000 in debt making the film.
And the filmmaker will be there on Sunday. We have Beau Bodart and Frank Dorrell, and yourself will all be on hand for a discussion on Sunday night at the Clinton Street. That's at 26th and Clinton in Southeast Portland. I want to go ahead and welcome some folks onto the air as well. So 503-231-8187. Go ahead and join us. And you can also, throughout the week, like Positively Revolting on Facebook. You can follow along on Twitter at Positive Revolt. And let's go ahead and talk to Tim. Good morning, Tim. You are on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. You know, I agree with, you know, a lot of the stuff he says. Just that I think when you say that America was founded on, you know, plundering and murder and theft and all that, well, I think every other country and great civilization was founded on the same thing, you know?
Yes, I happen to agree. I happen to be living in this one.
Right. And, I mean, that was 250 years ago or whatever, and things have changed since then. But, yeah, I mean...
Well, no, actually, the point was they haven't. That same energy is present today.
Oh, yeah, well, it's present all over, and it probably always will be.
I don't agree with that, but I don't think it's always been there, but it's been there in modern historical records. It's true, and I happen to think that it is a very destructive model, and it's almost destroyed me. So I agree that history is full of imperial plunder, and we're only the latest one on block. However, because of technology now and the nature of weaponry, and the nature, I think, of our globally based narcissism, we are now the most dangerous empire, but because it's 2000 and we have all these weapons that weren't available before, and we seem to just not know anything but using them, because that's the you US, make them and you use them.
The U.S. is the biggest arms dealer in the world,
correct,
is
by
it?
Far.
Mm-hmm.
What did they used to say? Donald Rumsfeld said, "I know they have weapons of mass destruction. We have the receipts."
I don't think he really said that, but I like the attribution. He should have. Thanks very much for joining us, Tim. Did you have anything else?
Thank you.
All right. Take care. And let's go ahead and talk to George. Good morning, George. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Got a question. Hearing your speaker... reading Howard Zim's People's History of America really, really affects me enormously, because I think I sort of, as Edgar Speaker did, came out of the ether during the Vietnam War days and realized what this country represents. And I really hold that it's our education that is so lacking. I feel that Americans simply do not know their history. If we go back and look at how we've been, what did we do to the American Indians? We had slavery for 300 years. In 1812, we invaded Canada and burned down their capital of York, which is now Toronto. But we know that they burned down our capital, but people don't know that that was payback. In 1846, Winfield Scott took an army and invaded Mexico, and after about seven battles, to the Battle of Mexico City in that treaty, we took the western United States. How did we get Hawaii? We had 200 Marines on shore when we overthrew the Queen of Hawaii in 1898. In 1917, we jumped into the First World War. What would have the war turned out, and what would the treaties have been like, the treaty have been like, had we not entered the war? There might not have been a Second World War had we stayed out of the First World War. Of course, in World War 41, we entered the, we didn't have much of a choice, but we were in the involved in the Second World War. And of course, that was the war, you know, the so-called good war. And I think people's opinion about wars have been so much altered by the so-called good war. And then we did things like, and I'm just hitting the highlights.
Yes.
In 53, we threw over Mohammed Mossadegh in Iraq.
And I know, it goes on and on and on.
And really, I mean, we could probably be here until, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 this afternoon as we list all of the incursions that have spread this imperialist.
Panama. Yeah. They forget about, what was that island in the Caribbean we invaded?
Grenada.
Yeah, I mean, and then you know, I protested against.
So what are we going to do about it?
Yeah.
Well, I know, just one more. Against the entry into the Iraq war, and people called me a traitor. They called me seditious. I'm so frustrated. I think it stems from the education, and I think it also stems from the media. You know, and probably in 90% of this country, they're all right-wing talkers on the radio. There's no television.
Don't listen to them. Turn them off. Just turn that. You can. Yeah. Just turn them off. It's okay.
A few of us actually do venture forth and listen because it's important to know what they're saying.
That.
But
so you don't have to. We do that so you don't have to.
Well, I don't. Well, that's why I'm a supporter of GABU.
Good.
And that's why I had Ani come out and talk to this Senior Studies Institute, of which I'm a member.
That was a fabulous day, by the way.
Yeah, well, thank you for doing that. But anyway,
well, thanks
I don't
for the
know the
history
answer.
Lesson,
I wish
George.
I did.
Yeah.
I try in my own way.
Well, that's all you can do, babe.
And together we find those solutions, right? And that is the joy of community radio. That is how we share these ideas and these thoughts and this information. Thanks, George, very much for your call this morning.
You bet. Take care.
Take good care. Yeah, I don't think any of us know the answers. If we did, we'd already have the changed world, right?
Well, and one person cannot do it.
And so together, again, this is the way forward. 503-231-8187, the number to call. Let's go ahead and take Francis. And good morning. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good morning, Francis.
I really appreciate the discussion today. And your last caller, George, I really appreciate how he put the history in perspective really, really well. And I do appreciate your guests. 1969 was the year that I also came to a lot of revelations about a lot of things. And it has been a journey. And I appreciate listening to your journey. I think that we need to come up with a solution. And any woman who calls herself representing me needs to be able to stand up and say loud and clear that this country is stepping out of the war business, and we're not going to drop one more bomb on one more baby. And a woman could do that if she wasn't bought and sold by that industry. So
I know who you're talking about.
There is a way. There is a way. But it has to be somebody. It doesn't necessarily have to be a woman, but it has to be somebody who gives a dang about the little babies in this world. And that doesn't necessarily have to be a woman, but it has to be someone who truly cares. And I don't think we have really stepped out of the box, because that would be so simple to do. That would be easy to do, to just say, this country right here isn't going to play that war game anymore, and we know how culpable we've been in it, but we're stopping right now. Now, that would put the screeching hold on a lot of of those stock market things, but oh well, maybe that needs to happen, because that we do not need to have an economy that's based totally on perpetrating war and conflict.
Right.
All over the world, and that's what it's become.
It's yeah, war and conflict is not, it should not be the basis of how we make a living. Death is not how we make a living, right?
Making the babies happy would be a nice way to start doing some other kind of business.
Actually, gearing our economy to support human life and life on the planet in general instead of destroying
it. Thank you. And I would like to ask your guest, if he doesn't mind, if he would, I would truly like to get his perspective on what happened in Libya, the tragedy that happened in Libya.
All right.
And you guys take care, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Francis.
Bye-bye.
Before I address that, I'd like to say that one of the cultural structural problems we have is that really our individual and collective ways of life in this country really require imperialism to sustain it. And so the energy, the political energy for the political leaders really does come from a kind of a sense of entitlement in the culture that demands oil and titanium and lithium and so forth from all over the world to maintain it. So it's kind of, we're kind of facing, part of the prescription would be a radical downsizing of our lives, replaced by lots more cooperation and sharing in our communities. It would be a much different way of life. It's what the transition movement was talking about a few years ago, if you remember the transition movement. It's still going on worldwide. But it was to move from a carbon-based lifestyle to a non-carbon-based lifestyle. That is so radical when you understand that everything we do from the time we get up to the time we go to bed is based on burning carbon now for the last 100 years. And those carbon molecules go into the air when they're burned, and they create warming.
Right.
So it's kind of like we are all, in a way, complicit in this whole modern way of life, even though we don't have evil intent. The solution then is us changing the way we live and becoming much more independent from the political system, which we now need to kind of keep the oil coming and the cars coming. So our choices and our consciousness does provide the basis for new politics, but it's pretty radical. And I think a lot of the young people today really see it really clearly. And so and when Occupy came on in 2011, I was thrilled. I was been waiting for that since 1970. Wow. They're talking about class, and they're know that the whole system is corrupt. And
well, and it's suicidal.
It's
suicidal. The fact that at this point, if the energy companies wanted to go to non-carbon based energy, they would be making, it's not about money, they would be making tons of money.
Yeah.
This is about a suicidal stubbornness that I don't have any anything to say. It leaves me speechless.
I was going to say, it's a rare thing that I see.
But we do need to have these conversations, because we need to be validating one another's questions and notions about how we got trapped in this, and now how do we get untrapped? And even despair, we need to acknowledge despair, because acknowledging despair, as Joanna Macy describes, is a way to become empowered now.
Yes.
To begin some kind of action to respond to the despair. And I've had to deal with that, you know, off and on for 47 years now.
Yeah.
It does require being honest with your feelings, the uncomfortable feelings, and not running from them, because then they become really powerful. And
they're much bigger
than,
yes.
And just in response to the issue about Libya, I don't know much about Libya because I live in the United States and I'm not in Libya. But I don't trust anything the U.S. says about anything. I know that they lie, and that is the general principle. And we also don't even know much about the true nature of Gaddafi. Gaddafi was a very revolutionary guy when he first came in power in the 70s. And he had nationalized their oil. And he wasn't just...
That never goes over well with the United
States. Right. The audacity of other people having our oil.
Yes.
But, I mean, so I just know that whatever happened in Libya was really terrible because the United States was involved.
And so far, we haven't seen an example of our motives being pure. Or actually bringing... Never mind. Anyway, let's... We've only got a few minutes left. We are so quickly running out of show. And we haven't really talked very much about the screening on Sunday or about the film itself. The film is about your life, Brian. So, and really looking at your life as an activist for peace. You want to go ahead and just tell us how this came to be, how this involvement with the film.
Well, my book came out in 2011, Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson. And a new friend of mine that I met on the book tour while I was in New England said that she had read my book in a matter of 3 or 4 nights when I was in New England. And she contacted me and said she wanted to call a filmmaker friend of hers because she thought this story should be a documentary. And her friend happened to be Bo Boudart. And so she called Bo, who I did not know. And at some point not long after that, when I was in Baltimore on the book tour, no longer in New England, he showed up at one of my book talks and introduced himself and began filming. That was in November of 2011. So he's been working on this for almost 5 years. And... it's more than about me. It's kind of about the peace movement in this country. A lot of people are interviewed in that film. I'm kind of the thread that weaves through it, but by no means is it just about me. It's about a much larger force of consciousness that emerges out of people when they realize we've been... brainwashed or lied to.
You've been bamboozled, I believe.
Right.
Malcolm X said.
That's right. We've been bamboozled. So a lot of the film, it does go into my early life a little bit, and but it does go into, and it does, it's pretty hard-hitting about the history of U.S. intervention and our assassinations of other leaders and our attempts to overthrow other governments 60 times and since World War II, or maybe since...
We've been so busy. It's hard to keep
count. And what explains it? You know, that's a pattern. And to me, pattern language is really important to understand because that kind of contradicts most rhetoric. The pattern, it's the revelations of your behaviors that really are telling. So... the film, it's been through many drafts and revisions. I've had lots of issues with Bo about the film, but it's his film, his money, and he's made 30 films. It's his art. I have to defer to him, and he's not been egocentric about the film. So he's been easy to talk to when I have issues. He doesn't get all defensive. He doesn't always agree, but I mean, he does it in a way that's not really alienating. So I have to give him a lot of credit. And he put a lot of his own money into this film.
He'll be present at the screening on Sunday.
He'll be present, and the money, the proceeds, the $10 admission fee goes to him to recoup his. I mean, he really got into the story. And therefore, he dipped into his own savings. And
not for your vacation home, so.
Right. So anyway, he'll be there. The social producer Frank Doral from L.A. will be there. I'll be there, and I hope a lot of people will be there.
And that's Sunday night at the Clinton Street. You can find out more information about that at the Clinton Street website, cstpdx.com. You can also find out, there's a link to it on our Facebook page. Oh, speaking of Facebook, you can like our page while you're there on Facebook, Positively Revolting. There are links to the premiere screening on Sunday at the Clinton Street. You can also, while we're at it, like follow along on Twitter.
And by the way, the film has its own Facebook page. I think it's called Paying the Price for Peace.
Yeah. And it also has a link on our Facebook page to that. Yes, it does. Paying the Price for Peace is exactly the link on Facebook. Gosh, only a few minutes left. Again, we haven't actually gotten into some of the really critical events in your life, in the sort of your carrying forth your consciousness. We've talked about that essential change and the change in consciousness, the awakening, and your commitment to forever since, you know, work for peace and against imperialism. And you just mentioned that you had a book come out, Blood on the Tracks, that really was the inspiration for the film coming together, Paying the Price for Peace. You want to talk about the direct action you were involved with in 1987 for listeners that actually haven't known your story.
Well, most people don't know the story.
See, really. I find this hard to believe because I have been listening
KBOO.
To you
know.
And reading your stuff for years. And your commitment to this movement and to taking direct action to stop evil is really inspiring. And if you could spend a moment telling us about that.
Well, the journey is organic, so it's not like it's been planned in advance and, you know, things unfold kind of in their own rhythm.
When does that ever happen? Okay, well, whatever.
Well, I've learned a little bit about focusing on my breath and meditations and kind of being more present in the moment. I mean, those are all things I've learned. I was an activist all through the 70s in domestic prison and criminal injustice issues. I was a lawyer, and I was not practicing because I discovered I couldn't even comply with the protocol of the court. I was just so alienated around standing up when the judge walks in or things like that.
Oh, yeah, any of that. Right, sure.
I just knew I was not going to be able to do that. I didn't know that before I experienced it in the courtroom. But anyway, so then in the 80s, I got real involved in understanding Ronnie Reagan's rhetoric about the Soviet beachhead in Latin America and communism and all that. And of course, I knew that was all code words for dealing with poor people who are organizing to become more empowered to have justice for their lives. And I was reading a lot, and I was speaking out a lot at rallies in New England where I was living at the time. And then in 1986, I went to Nicaragua to study Spanish. I haven't learned Spanish yet, but I went down there to study Spanish in 1986. And I was right away exposed to the Contra attacks near where I was living in Esteli, and there were 11 people killed in those attacks the first week I was there. And I saw six of those bodies coming into the cemetery in Esteli in open caskets. And I said, wow, this is the behavior that builds Western civilization in my country. And it hit me in a new, visceral way. And I came back to the States after that, and I was meeting other veterans, and we said, what are we going to do? And then three veterans I met, that we decided to go on a long water-only fast in Washington in 1986, protesting Reagan's wars. And we did 47-day fast on the steps of the Capitol. That was in September, October 1986, four of us. I lost 50 pounds, and we were representing people who were dying. You look at us, you say, if you feel bad for us, think of all those people you don't see and you don't feel. Well, then exactly a year later, September 1st, 1987, and we started the fast on September 1st, 86. I was part of an action at a military weapons depot in California. I'd been involved actually since June, July, August, blocking munitions trucks and trains. I was simply an observer and a jail support person for those 3 months. Many people were getting arrested. I was observing and soaking up that energy. And I decided that on September 1st, 87, I and two other veterans would go on a 40-day fast of water on the tracks. They would have to, they would know that for 40 days, that's where we were going to be if we weren't in jail. And so I wrote a letter to the base commander, said this is exactly what we're going to do when we start and why, and we'd like to meet with you if you'd like to understand our motivations. And of course, that meeting didn't happen, despite repeated requests to have that meeting. And on the day that I started the fast with these two other veterans, we knew the protocol was the train moves at 5 miles an hour at most, usually at 3 or 4 miles an hour. There's two spotters on the front of the train who's on radio contact with the engineer in case there's any problems on the tracks. There's 350 armed Marines protecting the trains and the trucks. The penalty on the sign next to our vigil said penalty for blocking munitions trains is a $5,000 fine and 1 year in prison. So we knew what the consequences were. So we took our position that morning, and the first train came up just about noon. But I woke up in a hospital about 4 days later, being told what had happened. The train sped up to 17 miles an hour. They were under orders not to stop. And we discovered that later. And I was in the hospital, completely bandaged from head to foot, practically, with people telling me what had happened. And I have, still to this day, have no memory. But the train ran over me. The other two guys just barely escaped. I lost both legs. I had a pretty severely fractured skull. I lost my right frontal lobe in that whole thing because the skull was so fractured it destroyed my right side of my frontal lobe. And it, you know, I had like all total 19, I think, broken bones. And all these ribs are cracked and my elbows are cracked. And
yeah, a train ran over you.
Completely ran over me. I went underneath and
the expression
was five photographers and a videographer there to document the arrest.
Right.
And they got something else, and I survived. It's kind of like, how does that happen? You know, you were hit by a 200,000-pound locomotive, and you survived, and it's all documented.
Sounds like, you know, if one believed in the universe having a consciousness, sounds like you have something to do with your life, Brian.
I mean, you know, it was just fate or destiny. I don't know.
That is the Fickle Finger of Fate Award, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I went through all kinds of psychological tests in the hospital because of the brain injury, and you know, at least I looked like I came out at least in normal range with a I think there was 12 different things they tested. And I remember I couldn't do rhymes and riddles. I still remember that. If that's the worst of it, I won't be able to do rhymes and riddles. But I could converse. I could have interactions with people. And I was newly married at the time with a woman named Holly who saved my life on the tracks because she was a trained midwife and she knew, and she was the one organizing stopping my bleeding because the Navy ambulance came very quickly and then left because they said my body wasn't lying technically on Navy property. It was on the right-of-way highway. And my leg apparently was on the line, but my body itself was on the right-of-way. There was a painted line there, demarcated the property of the Navy. I had 45 friends there that day, 12 of whom were Vietnam veterans. And there were five of those people, including Holly, who saved my life while a county ambulance came 17 minutes later. I'm lucky.
There's a word.
And fortunate. And I never really got terribly depressed about it, even after I knew what had happened, because I was doing what I said I was going to do. And the Navy, the three train crew members, all veterans, now civilian employees of the Navy, were under orders. And, they're still following orders. And I stopped doing that.
Right. Well, I hate to do this, but we are running out of show. And folks, you can learn more about this and Brian's amazing